Hello and welcome to a new edition of Plain Talking. In this podcast, we'll hear from Release International's Andrew Boyd, who will share with us some terrifying developments in Uganda. Brother David Jardine will also tell us about his journey of healing. But we begin with Northern Ireland. The BBC has recently broadcast a five-part documentary series called Once Upon a Time in Northern Ireland. It combines raw personal accounts with archive footage to tell the story of the people and communities who had to live with daily violence and are still dealing with its legacies today. The series gives a voice to the people who lived through the Troubles, sharing intimate stories from all sides of the conflict. David Hamilton is not one of the voices heard in this extraordinary series, but his story is captivating. He is now an evangelist and pastor, but it was not always so. I recently met David, whose life has been shaped by the Troubles, and I began by asking him about his early years.
Yes, well, everything in my life was normal for a boy in Northern Ireland. I lived in a housing estate that was probably predominantly Protestant, but some of my friends were Roman Catholics. But at the age of 13, a bomb exploded and blew me out of bed. It was just across the road from my house. It was the first bomb explosion I'd ever heard. And when I went out, all the neighbors and everybody was out on the street pointing to where the blast had been. And somebody was saying, that was the IRA. And I was saying, who are they? And then they told me it was a Republican movement, mostly Catholics. And that was my introduction to it. And then this was 1969, so I was 13 at this stage, and that really was the start then of the conflicts that came to be known as the Troubles in Northern Ireland. I was probably around 15 when I was walking through a glen on my way home from school when a group of boys approached me, four or five of them, and I knew they were Roman Catholics by their school uniform. But when they got up to me, one of them said to the others, I think we should beat Davy Hamilton up. And that was me. And I was surprised to hear this. The next thing, the guy started punching me. And after they beat me, they tossed me into the river. It wasn't much of a beating, I guess, but I was more in shock by wondering why they had attacked me. But as they turned to walk away, one of them stopped and looked around. He says, you don't know why we did that? And I says, no. He says, well, I'll have to tell you then. You are a Protestant and we are Catholics. And Protestant and Catholics fight with each other. So that was the turning point that day in my life then. I thought, that's it. I no longer will have Roman Catholic friends. From now on, there'll be only Protestant. And that's the way then that whole separation became part of my life then. So that was a separation for me then. From that day on, I had only Protestant friends. I became part of a tartan gang that was all Protestant and would fight with Roman Catholic gangs. And from that then, I was in a youth club one night, 16, when these men came in with army uniform and set them on top of the table tennis table. And one of them said, we are starting a Protestant paramilitary group to fight the IRA, and we want gang members to join. And that's what happened. Overnight, I got involved with this group. It wasn't long when they started to train us with guns and things, so I started to get weapon training, and I was arrested not long after for armed robberies, and I was put in prison. And I was in prison then for a year, what was called long cash, and we were treated as political prisoners. We had political status, but I was sentenced to 2 years, and when I got out of jail again, I just came straight back. That very night I got out of jail, I got back involved again in the paramilitaries. And I was involved in all of the paramilitary activities, what you do. At some stage, I probably took part in everything. And then I was rearrested again in After interrogation in the police interrogation centre, I was taken into prison. I was in prison a year, and then I was sentenced at court. I got a total of 28 years. So I knew I'd be doing maybe 12 to 15 years in jail.
So, David, you're in prison. You're doing this long stretch. Because I've read something of your story, I know that something transformative happens in your life around about this time.
Yes, I'd been in prison probably about 2 years at the time. And just one night I went into my cell as usual. I was carrying a cup of tea, hot water, to make a cup of tea for myself, which you always did when you were being locked up. This is half seven in the evening. But there was a bit of paper lying on my bed. And I walked over and picked it up to see what it was. And when I turned it over, it was a gospel tract. And I just laughed when I looked at it. I read it and I made a joke of it. I said, Jesus Christ is coming back soon. And I laughed and said to a cinema near you, and my cellmate laughed as well. And I rolled it up in a ball and just tossed it out the window. I wasn't interested in anything Christian.
What changed that then, David? What happened for that that leap to take place, if you like?
I was sitting on my bed drinking my tea, and a voice spoke to me, and I heard it so clear, but it was in my head. It wasn't an audible voice, but this thought, if you like, was, David, it's time to change, become a Christian. I heard this, David, it's time to change. And I thought, become a Christian. And I sit on the bed and I said to myself, prison is bad, but church is worse. Because I have been to church as a child, as a boy, a young boy, and I knew the procedure. This man dressed up like Batman and came out. And then there was even bouncers on the door, although they called them elders. And I thought, oh, this is not a good place. I did not enjoy it. But here I am sitting on my bed in prison, and this thought seemed to become a Christian. And I thought, this is a strange thought. But you know, I finished my cup of tea and I walked over to set the cup on the bookshelf. And you're allowed six books. And one of the six books that every prisoner kept was a Bible, the Gideon's. They put these Bibles in prison. And I lifted the Bible. It was the King James. And I opened it just at random. And I read it and said, whence comest thou hither? And I was laughing. And I was saying, what's that, Sipis de Bo? Everything's written backwards in this. How are you meant to read this? And my cellmate laughed. And I set the Bible back on the shelf. But you know what? I just walked back over to the bed and sat down again. And I thought, that's strange. Wait till I lift the Bible to read it. And I got up again and went back over again and picked it up again. And so my cellmate was watching me and he says, what are you doing? I says, I had this thought about becoming a Christian. And he laughed. He says, you're a bad man. He says, you couldn't be a Christian. God wouldn't accept you. And even that bothered me when he said that, because you don't see yourself as bad. I compared myself with other guys and says, now he's a bad one, but I'm not. You're fooling yourself, you know, thinking like this. But I sat back down on the bed and again it happened. David, God has spared your life. It is God that has kept you alive. And I thought, God has kept me alive. I would have said I was lucky. But I wouldn't have brought God into it. And for the next half an hour or so, God brought revelation to me back to occasions where I should have died. I was planting a bomb one time in a building, and as I was exiting the building, the bomb exploded prematurely and blew me up in it. And I woke up lying on the ground, and the building was on fire, and my clothes were tore to shreds. And I thought, I'll be cut to pieces. And when I stood up and examined myself, there was not so much as a scratch. And yet my clothes were torn. And I thought, oh, I've been lucky. But that night sitting, when that thought came into my head, sitting there on the bed, I thought, was that God? And then I thought, but God only loves good people. Why would God save me, a terrorist? And that was the whole dilemma for me, thinking that God would intervene in my life. Another time, probably my worst experience, I was walking up the street and a guy on the other side, as I happened to look over, but he was watching me and thought, why is he watching me? Is he following me? And as I turned again, then he discerned that I was watching him, and he ran across and he opened his jacket and he pulled out a gun. And as he came over, he pointed the gun at my head, and I reached out and grabbed his arm and pulled his arm down. But he shot me 3 times, and I was lying on the ground. And as I was lying on the ground, he leaned over and he put the gun right to my head. And I looked up at him. When he pulled the trigger, the gun jammed.
Mm.
That's what happened.
Mm.
And he cursed me then and ran off. And people heard the shooting and came out, and they put me into a car and got me to the hospital.
Mm.
And they operated and took 3 bullets out of me. But you know what? I was sitting on the bed in jail. I said to myself, was that God? Was that God protecting me? And I thought, why? Why? And I thought, this just doesn't make sense, because if God only loves good people, surely he would have just let me die. Why would he intervene in my life? But you know what was the strangest thing about this? Something happened to me, because there was like hope rose up in me, and I thought, God has spared my life. He could change my life. I live in fear of the IRA getting a hold of me. There was always the fear of, you know, being killed in the Troubles. Mm. I'd survived this shooting, but I thought you could die just as easy, or you could be killed in prison by terrorists even. But fear was a big part of my life. You were always alert and watching what you were doing.
Mm.
And then I thought, God could take away all this hatred that I have and the bitterness. I was a violent man. I'd been involved in prison riots, even had been shot in prison by a soldier during a riot. So violence was a big part of my life. And I'm sitting on the bed and I thought, if God has kept me alive, he could change me. And I just says, I am going to pray and ask the Lord Jesus Christ to forgive me my sin, and ask him to change me and make me a new person. And that was the decision I made. And I waited till my cellmate had fell asleep. And when I knew he was sleeping, I actually got out and knelt down and I prayed. And I didn't know how to pray, really. This was the first time. But I knew that I had to ask for God's forgiveness. I knew that, or I knew I was going to hell. But God in his mercy listened to my prayer, and I got up off my knees and I was smiling to myself when I got into bed. The next morning when I woke up, even my cellmate looked at me and he says, what are you smiling for? And I laughed. He says, I become a Christian last night. I had a joy in my heart and I knew the reality of God, and I thought, no, this is real. But you know, I had still 5.5, 6 years to do in jail, and people thought it wouldn't last. But I'm going to tell you this. I am now a Christian 43 years, and that joy has never left me. And for me, salvation was discovering that God had a plan and purpose for your life. It's good to know that your sins are forgiven. And I knew that instantly, that God had forgiven me for everything I had done.
Mm.
But you know, that's not enough just to say, oh, when you die, you're going to heaven. But I had this joy and peace. And I knew God had a call on my life. He told me that through the scriptures. And I began to be an evangelist in prison. And I seen other terrorists. I even seen prison officers led to the Lord. I even led an IRA man to the Lord over the years I was in prison. And those next 5 years or so as a Christian, I even taught myself New Testament Greek. So when I went to Bible college when I got out, but 3 years later, I actually got a distinction.
Wow.
In Testament Greek. I didn't tell them I had started away long earlier before the rest of them.
Militants linked to Islamic State terrorists have carried out a massacre at a boarding school in western Uganda, killing and kidnapping students. It's been described as the deadliest attack in Uganda since 2010. I asked Andrew Boyd from Release International to explain what's happening in that part of the world.
Well, the latest attack in Uganda has been described as the worst terrorist attack that's happened in that country, the most deadly attack since 2010. What happened is that a group of insurgents who are affiliated to Islamic State, they're known as the Allied Democratic Forces, attacked a school. They've been blamed for it. They haven't claimed responsibility, but they are the most likely people to have done it. They attacked a school which was very close to the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. And this was a boarding school. They moved in and they killed, the latest figures are, at least 43 people there. It was a massacre. They killed school children, the girls with machetes, and they firebombed the boys' dormitories, burning them to death. 17 of them were burnt beyond recognition. So the latest figures we have on that are that 38 of the dead are students, 5 of them are villagers, 17 boys, 20 girls, the victims aged between 12 and 70, others wounded, and 6 of them kidnapped. It's the first raid by the ADF on a school in Uganda in 25 years. The first was even more deadly.
Uganda has been described, or is being described now, as the epicenter of world terrorism, which sounds terrifying. Can you explain why it's known as that?
Yes, it's not so much Uganda that's been described as that. You're quoting a report by the Global Terrorism Index, and what it's saying is that the violence that we've seen now for many years in Nigeria, northeastern Nigeria, that's spreading across Nigeria, but that has erupted from Nigeria into the borders of the countries around it, including places like Burkina Faso and Mali, where you have a very strong jihadist Islamic State influence there. Now, the Sahel region, of which these countries are part, is a band that stretches right the way across Africa. It's where the Sahara Desert gives way to the savannah, where sand turns green. And then below that, in sub-Saharan Africa, this is where the terrorist groups are now basing themselves. So Islamic State, if you think back to the Iraq War, we remember well what happened when Islamic State occupied Mosul and they killed the Christians and they abused and they killed the Yazidis. Now that area has been largely cleaned out. But what's happening here is that in this region of Africa now, the Sahel and sub-Saharan Africa, this is where the Islamic terrorists have now made their base. And that's why Global Terrorism Alliance, an authoritative source, is identifying that as the epicenter of terrorism. In fact, Islamic State have put out a call for jihadists to go to that area to help them form a new Islamic State in that region. Uganda is one of the countries that's being caught up in that.
It sounds terrifying. It sounds like living in this part of the world must be a nightmare for many, many people. Children are being caught up in this. Do you see any signs of hope in the midst of all this terror, Andrew?
Oh, always. Always we see signs of hope in it. So Release International has a partner who is based in this region, has been there for a long time, and has described the growing influence of jihadists there. She's seen 600 jihadi schools set up in Burkina Faso alone. And yet, she says, in the face of this slaughter and this violence, she says that Christians are growing. They're growing in their faith and they're growing in their courage. That's not just wishful thinking. That's actually her measured response to what's going on there. And yet she's very aware that the Islamists are trying to set up an Islamic State in the Greater Sahara and regards this, as does Release International, as a wake-up call to the world. We've had our eye off the ball on this. We've not been really watching what's been going on in the Sahel region. We've tended to turn a blind eye to what's been going on in Nigeria, as has the Nigerian government. So the United States State Department has delisted Nigeria as a country of particular concern. That's a terrible error to make. So this violence is spreading from Nigeria to the region. And yes, indeed, this is a wake-up call for us all. But the church there is growing. And when we look at these things, what we're seeing is a reaction to the spread of the Christian gospel. So one of the things that I take comfort from is that the nature of evil is such that all it can do is disfigure, destroy and mar what God, who is love, has made. It can just tear down. It can never build up. It can never create. It shows, the very existence of evil shows that there is a God who is greater and a God who has defeated the evil of these things, because these things are utterly appalling. They are terrifying. They're designed to create terror, but they have been defeated and disarmed on the cross by Christ. So these things are a desperate backlash against the steady advance of the gospel in these regions.
And finally, Brother David Jardine muses on divine healing.
I have been involved in the ministry of divine healing since 1972. That is more than 50 years. And the reason I became involved is because I needed prayer myself. I had been ill, and doctors didn't seem to be able to get to the bottom of it. What saved me was the fact that I worked at the time with one of the great men produced by the Church in Ireland in the 20th century, the Reverend Cecil Kerr. Cecil was already involved in the ministry of divine healing, and so the next time he was taking the Friday lunchtime service in St. Anne's Cathedral, he invited me to go with him. But I went forward that day to kneel at the communion rail and receive prayer and the laying on of hands for the first time. It was an emotional moment. And when I felt the peace and power of God flow through me, I was converted immediately. I knew there was something in this ministry, and I knew that if I were ever sick again in the future, I could take advantage of it. I also knew that I could use this form of ministry myself when I was dealing with people who were sick or in difficulties. In those days, there were not so many people around who were knowledgeable about divine healing, so I got a lot of my information from books. I particularly liked the work of Canon Jim Glennon from St. Andrew's Cathedral in Sydney. He specialized in teaching us how to draw on the peace and healing of God for ourselves through faith. He had learned that lesson himself when he had a nervous breakdown in the middle 1960s. He made a complete recovery, and he continued to pray the prayer of faith for the rest of his life. I only met Jim once. That was in 1993, when he made his only visit to Ireland. He stayed with the Franciscan brothers in the friary in North Belfast. He had a heavy infection when he came to us. So next morning after our communion service, I asked Jim if he would like the brothers to pray with him. He said, yes, I would. So we gathered around Jim and prayed with the laying on of hands. Next day, Jim also came to the communion service. I asked him again, would he like us to pray with him? On this occasion, he said, no, I've got that sorted out. Right to the end of his life, he never stopped drawing by faith on the peace and the healing of God for himself. In one of his books, Jim said that when someone came to him seeking healing, he gave them 1 hour, listening, talking, and praying. The next time they came to him, he listened to the report of how they were doing. When they mentioned any healing that had taken place, within himself, Jim started to praise God. He didn't worry about whatever healing was still needed. He simply praised God for the healing that had already taken place. For anyone recovering from illness, I feel that that is a good attitude to take. I myself had an operation 2 years ago. At times I felt that healing was slow, and sometimes when people asked me how I was, I focused too much on what still needed to be done. Eventually, I changed my response. When someone asked me how I was, I said I was fine and listed all the things that I could do: driving, preaching, conducting worship, cutting the grass, washing the car, walking good distances, etc. I didn't focus on what still needed to be done. I left that in God's hands. That to me is a much more healthy approach. We live in an age when there's a great deal of negativity and criticism. We're even encouraged by the media to take these attitudes. Maybe it would help if instead of focusing on what we have not yet received, we praised God for everything that he has given to us, even little things. It would certainly help to lift our spirits, take our minds off our own difficulties, and even quicken up the healing process.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Plain Talking. If you enjoyed it, then please leave a review wherever you found this podcast. Plain Talking is sponsored by the Plain Truth magazine, a magazine of understanding. If you'd like to find out more, please visit plain-truth.org.uk. Many thanks for listening, and God bless until next time.